Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Really, market risk and the price of credits and this really emerging market is really completely intertwined with production risk or the contractual arrangements. These really can't be separated. They're all part and parcel of this together. And so I'm going to hit a few things in this really what I would call an emerging market for carbon credits.
Texas A&M livestock economist David Anderson.
On the assignment of these, you may enter an agreement with somebody and they may assign it to someone else. I think we ought to expect that there's going to be new entrants to this market and even some consolidation as we go forward, where some of these firms that are putting together buyers and sellers may consolidate and change. And we ought to expect to see that. And that's part of a new and emerging market.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This term that we see a lot, the dollar value of about $20 per ton.
Dr. David Anderson, Texas A&M livestock economist on carbon markets.
And that range, you'll see a range from $18 to $22. That's really become a price or a value that's been quoted a lot in the marketplace. I think it's very important to realize that, again, to reiterate what Tiffany said, in dollars per ton, if the change in carbon in your soil that you're looking at is 0.1 ton, then that change, that value per acre, is going to be about $2. So we're really talking about this in terms of the change you're going to provide. Again, dovetailing with this production risk that Jason talked about, with this value in the marketplace of really $20 per ton. So again, that idea of change, the increase in production, this is really the marketplace that we're seeing right now. So again, I think there's a couple of important parts here. The companies, a Google or whoever who are buying these may very well be paying much more for that dollars per ton, but these companies in the middle who are putting this together and making this market happen have costs as well. And so we're getting to this idea of this $20 per ton net to a farmer or rancher. On this production risk idea, lots of ag practices can store carbon, as we've talked about. And what I would get us to think about is that we are competing in this marketplace. As either we think of it as ranchers or as the rangeland, the rangeland's ability to increase carbon storage, we are competing in a marketplace, with all the way from forestry and trees, row cropping systems, to a lot of other more high tech systems for pulling carbon out of the air. And if we think about in this marketplace, every one of these practices has a cost with them to provide. This $20 per ton of carbon in the marketplace then really kind of dictates what kind of practices we're going to see first. And the ones that are the lowest cost to provide or that can be profitably provided at $20 per ton is what's going to happen first. So, you know, I would work into this. I think it's very important as we figure out, am I changing my practices on the ranch, my grazing system, whatever it is I'm doing to increase soil carbon storage to then generate this carbon payment? I would really strongly urge the thing to think about is those practices that you're putting in place have to be profitable to do. If we think of this $20 per ton and the net price being some fraction of that based on how much the increase in carbon you can get, some of those dollars, if, for example, if it's 0.1 ton, it's $2 per acre. That's not a lot of money in terms if we think about increasing or changing our system of production that may very well change our costs, but also may change our returns. So I want to think about this, not just signing a contract and getting a check, but how it fits into the total ranch operation so that the practice you're putting in place is profitable to do so first. I think that's really a kind of a critical thing to think about in this market.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've had questions in recent weeks about the possibility of retained ownership from some cow-calf operations that have historically sold wean calves or maybe used cool season grass and turned them into yearlings.
Talking five key components of retained ownership, Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State University Extension Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist.
First thing, if we're looking at retained ownership, it's based on low cow inventories, fewer amounts of calves and fed cattle being marketed in the future. We're looking at backing up our marketing endpoint to a time when we anticipate the prices will be better. So what should we consider if we look at doing this? First, realize if we're going to retain ownership and actually be selling fed cattle, in the modern beef industry, the vast majority of fed cattle are sold on a carcass value basis. That's not to say that this doesn't vary a little bit by region, and you can't still potentially sell some live, but the majority of cattle are priced on a carcass value basis. Now, what does that mean? Basically, we take our finished cattle, they're harvested, a USDA grader is going to come in and assign quality grades and yield grades, and optimum combinations of quality and yield grades, say something that is better than a low choice yield grade 3, are going to be up for premiums or better than average market prices, and poorer combinations are going to be in for discounts and penalties. We're going to sell those on a price per pound of carcass. There's also the potential if we have carcasses that are too heavy or too light, we take some discounts there. Second thing we ought to consider is the opportunity cost on that money. If we've historically sold wean calves and we hang on to those rascals longer, we are looking at volatility in markets. We're looking at potential death loss that we haven't dealt with at earlier marketing endpoints. And so there's a new set of considerations there to think about as we look long-term and finishing out those cattle. Next thing I would consider is, do you have any data that tells you how your cattle have done after you've sold them in the past, or particularly how your calves have done? If you've historically sold wean calves or yearlings, have you gotten any feedback on what the death loss or the cost of gain or the pull rate for health issues or potentially those quality grades, yield grades, carcass weights, finish weights on those calves? Have you got any data that tells you some stuff as far as what you can anticipate there? Next thing I would consider, and another factor in here economically, the same drought that's impacting us and causing us to liquidate cows is impacting the grain growing parts of the United States. Feed grains are historically high. The cost of gain associated with finishing out cattle in the future is going to be historically high as well. It's going to be a lot more than what we've typically had in those cattle. Say we were turning wean calves into yearlings. And if we fed some cattle out years ago, I'd anticipate that we're looking at a lot higher cost of gains on finished cattle than what we were in years past. Another thing to consider is, where have we typically put selection pressure whenever we were buying bulls? And if you have, for the past 5-10 years, put some selection pressure on post-weaning growth, carcass traits, things like marbling, ribeye size, fat thickness, and you've been retaining daughters out of those bulls, and they are now in production and raising calves sired by more bulls that have had that kind of selection pressure put on them, then retained ownership through finishing is potentially a means to capture additional value out of some of that investment in genetics that you've made. If you've been putting selection pressure in other places, we need to take that into account.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Number one, let's talk about the budget.
Barry Worsham, President and CEO of Cotton Incorporated.
The budget overall is $87 million compared to a little over $86 in 2022. It's a little bit misleading because our 2022 budget includes a fairly large supplemental budget and some other carryover numbers. So we actually got an additional $4.6 million. So it felt like this year's budget was a pretty good increase from 2022. One of the things we did in 2022 is there were some capital needs that we had for 2023 that we just thought that if we put it in the normal sort of budget that we wouldn't get it because of the port issues, because of shipping delays, manufacturing delays. So we front loaded some capital purchases to make sure we got those in a timely manner. And so that sort of artificially put the 22 numbers up. So when we compare 22 to 23 and we don't have capital needs in 23, we actually have more money for other types of programs. So like I said, it feels like an increase in our budget. And the Cotton Board, quite frankly, is has done a great job of managing the reserves. The reserves are at a level where we can have some fluctuations in the overall markets, whether it's the supply side or demand side. And we don't have as big a disruptions in our budget like we had from, say, 2013 to 2017, when the budget increased about 15 or so percent. And we've had even bigger changes prior to that. So we're in a position where we can be steady for a while, and that really helps in terms of executing programs that are really longer term in nature.
He also talks about plastic contamination.
Most of the cotton that's used around the world, or at least in the U.S. in terms of finished goods, probably contain a blend of some kind. So it's cotton. There's still a lot of 100% cotton products out there, but other products contain something else. It could be Lycra for stretch. It could be some other attribute. So we have to be mindful that in some cases we do have to use a few other fibers to get the performance we need. So we're always looking at ways of how to make the best products with cotton. And we're doing things with recycled synthetics and blends of sort of that haven't happened before. Maybe it's hemp and cotton or bio-based filaments, not just traditional type old, either 100% cotton or a 50-50 blend type thing. We kind of have to get past that. Novel constructions mean that you're trying to construct a fabric to have other characteristics, whether it's more breathable or it's maybe has some better insulation or potentially faster drying, UV protection. The consumer wants a lot of things that today and they don't want to have to pay for it. So you're trying to figure out ways of either adding a finish to it, or probably the better way to do it, if we can, is to just construct it in a way that would do that. So it'd be less expensive. We're always looking at the denim market because that is a big chunk of cotton demand. We're trying to reduce the environmental impact of denim processing. We're adding some technologies that Cotton Incorporated has developed, looking at different dye techniques and weaving variations to make the denim market fresh, because it's a heavyweight product and it contains, in most cases, 80 to 100% cotton.
Talks about the importance of getting back to events and telling this story.
But there's a lot of these that have been sort of canceled or postponed in the last couple of years. It'll be coming back. So if it's an important one, we'll be out there with, you know, here's things you can do with cotton. CCI in some cases are out there as well. So we work very close together on those.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This is legislation that really takes a historic step forward in three big areas.
Aviva Aaron-Dine is Deputy Director of the National Economic Council on the Inflation Reduction Act.
Making healthcare more affordable for people, making energy more affordable while combating the climate crisis, and making the tax system more fair. So to try to make each of those a little more tangible, on the healthcare side, one important thing this bill does is address the high and rising costs of prescription drugs. And some of the reforms in the bill are especially important to people in rural America because, as it happens, seniors disproportionately live in rural areas. And this bill makes a number of really important improvements in Medicare, including letting Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices for the first time, finally letting Medicare use its bargaining power to drive down the cost of the highest cost drugs with direct benefits for seniors, including making drug companies pay rebates to the federal government if they increase prices faster than inflation in Medicare. And that, again, has direct benefits for beneficiaries who will pay less in deductibles and co-pays because those prices are lower. It caps prescription drug costs at out-of-pocket prescription drug costs at a total of $2,000 for people with Medicare Part D starting in 2025, which is huge for people with high-cost conditions like cancer or lung disease or others. And it makes other improvements right away, like capping the cost of insulin at $35 a month for a month's supply for people in Medicare. Also really important to people in rural America are the continued improvements to the Affordable Care Act premium tax credits. Premiums for health insurance tend to be higher in rural areas for a lot of reasons, And so the improvements that were made in the American Rescue Plan that made health insurance through the ACA marketplaces more affordable have disproportionately benefited people in rural areas. And now those policies will continue through 2025. They've helped drive the national uninsured rate to its lowest level in U.S. history. And hopefully now we can build on that progress in rural areas in particular. Turning to climate and energy policy, there are also some really important investments here that will bring down electricity costs nationwide, but with a particularly big investment in rural electric cooperatives and making sure that there's a stable, durable, resilient, and affordable supply of electricity in rural areas. And then, you know, really important to all Americans, I think, are the improvements to the tax system and making sure that we have more of a level playing field with everybody, but in particular, high-income people and corporations paying their fair share and paying the taxes they owe.
If we're looking for one great example of inflation, it's been fuel prices at the pump.
Something I and my colleagues here watch closely, and we've been pleased to see a significant, in fact, historic decline in gas prices over the past weeks, but we're definitely not feeling complacent and still watching that very closely. The president has talked about how this is, you know, a top priority for him, making sure that he uses every tool in his power to mitigate the price hike that was caused by Putin's invasion of Ukraine. So, for example, the president undertook historic releases from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that helped to bring down prices relative to what they otherwise would have been. And again, we're pleased with the declines we've seen recently, but see the Inflation Reduction Act as really core to a medium and long-term strategy of greater energy security and reducing costs for people, including reducing the cost of electricity, including helping people afford to buy more fuel efficient vehicles, appliances for their homes, rooftop solar, other things that will bring down families' energy costs significantly over the coming years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're seeing cash wheat bids having declined. I think in the overall futures scope of things, as some moisture coming into parts of the U.S., that would help in the soil profile that would be needed to help get winter wheat established. Again, looking for moisture to be available September, October. So that was responded to, the promise of rain coming in.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien.
And also with the success in getting more wheat out of Ukraine through the agreed-upon shipment mechanisms that the UN and Turkey were involved in, I think the market sees that information and responds with the idea that, well, there's less pressure on tightness of supplies. I think that might be in question some. I still think the world situation is so tight that, yeah, we'll welcome any of that wheat coming out of there for humanitarian purposes, but we still have ongoing drought in the European Union and problems elsewhere. I think a quiet issue that's not being talked about so much is that Russia has a large crop projected to get a lot of wheat out of their country, but there's a, understand from ag market analysis, that the world's ability to actually get wheat out of Russia slowed down, and probably sanctions, other issues all in play. So the drop that we'd seen in the wheat markets yesterday, September contract down 38 cents. Yes, I can see why we might rationalize that, but boy, there's a long way to go before you declare that suddenly we're not going to have strength in the wheat markets. Cash prices, again, this is all be post-harvest now for our hard red winter wheat crops, still holding up pretty decently. Colby at 763, Salina, more of our export center, 797. 797 also in Hutchinson, those are the two highs in the state. And again, more central part, basis levels, strong, really, 16 under. And a lot of times for wheat, when we're not in the middle of a massive panic run-up, you know, we're at 40, 50 cents. Well, here, even at this time, we're 16 under, and that's indicating some strength. Topeka, 788. Columbus, 738. Even Colby and Garden City are in the act with about 45, 50 cent under prices. So interesting to look at. As we talked about the cash markets, still strong basis patterns, local demand for corn. You look at Garden City at 730, and actually Colby has a top bid of 740 over Garden City. Rare error for Colby. You know, Garden City is such a strong area. Columbus at 720. So you're all looking at $1 to $1.10 to $1.20 over. And so that just continues. We hear a lot of discussion amongst in the countryside of livestock feed feeders, ethanol users, people from out of state offering tremendous forward price bids for corn in anticipation of where we're at. There are worries about the availability of having enough trains to actually pull grain out of the central corn belt over here into western Kansas. So to me, you kind of bring all that together, and I know you have to balance what you actually see with what you hear might happen. But we're already at $1 to $1.20 over in some of these areas, and indicative of, I wouldn't say panicked buying, but very, very aggressive buying. People with businesses on the line, cattle and feedlots, ethanol plants they want to run, that are worried about having supplies. So, gee whiz, you look at that, we're at $1 to $1.20 over. It used to be that for a good number of years, we watched the Hereford, Texas bid as the leading regional bid for corn in this part of the world, and they were 40, 60 cents over, with the idea that that bid rewarded corn grown locally, but it was pulling, that was a train bid. They were pulling grain out of the eastern corn belt to come to Hereford, Texas. Wow. Well, now, where we're at, these Southwest Kansas bids, and well, all of Western Kansas bids, well, and Southeast too, we're operating in the same mode, but really in a massive demand pull mode to try to get corn in. So I know what the futures are doing, but in Kansas, we're seeing such strong demand that our basis levels are just adding on, stacking on top of whatever strength we get in the corn futures.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I serve as Senior Advisor for Agriculture to EPA Administrator Michael Regan.
Speaking at the recent American Coalition for Ethanol's annual meeting, Rod Snyder, Senior Advisor for Agriculture at EPA, on why he wanted to join the agency.
I was appointed by President Biden in October, and just about 10 months now on the job. It's my only time serving in government ever in any capacity. I spent the last 20 years working really with farmers and within the ag sector on the private sector side in a variety of capacities, the Corn Growers, Crop Life America, Field to Market. I think all of that really prepared me for this kind of a role, to try to bring really practical perspectives and expertise into the agency. Folks asked why I didn't go over to USDA. I said because they have tons of ag experts. I wanted to make sure that within EPA, that someone that has the direct ear of the administrator has this type of expertise to help advise on these kinds of issues, and it's really been a rewarding experience so far.
Snyder also talks about a change of approach at EPA when it comes to dealing with ag.
Earlier this spring, the administrator announced a new charge topic for EPA's Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee, which I have the privilege of staffing. We'll be focusing the work of this committee for the next 2 years at the nexus of climate and agriculture. I think that's the first time in the history of the Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Committee that has been the express focus. This includes evaluating all the ways in which the ag sector can be part of the climate solution, including through the production of low-carbon biofuels.
So let's turn from the environment to the economy, and right now looking at the strength of the dollar. Guy Allen is director of the International Grains Program at K-State.
I like to touch base on the dollar. It's something that, I guess, being a U.S. farmer or U.S.-based agribusiness, we think of everything in U.S. dollars day-to-day, and we don't think much about that exchange rate. Whereas if you're overseas in that international market, that exchange rate, that's the first thing I always looked at in the morning when I woke up. Well, what did the exchange rate do overnight? And then just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the U.S. dollar hit new 20-year highs. And just to look back in April, we were down with an index at about 90. Today, we're above 106, and we had reached as high as 109 just briefly last week. That's a significant increase. That's a 15 to 18% increase in the cost of U.S. commodities just because of the exchange rate. The other thing that I think is real important to keep in mind, that index is driven mostly by the relative value of the euro and the Japanese yen, where most of our importers of U.S. grain, their performance of their dollar or their exchange rate to the U.S. has actually performed significantly worse. So most of the people buying U.S. commodities are paying not just that dollar index, but significantly more than that for U.S. dollar-denominated grains.
And since we're already talking about trade, there are some concerns when we look at competitors abroad, specifically Australia.
I mentioned earlier Australia's winter crop production. They'll be harvesting wheat here starting in October. They're expecting it'll be one of the top three crops. They've had the last two years have been their best and second best record crops. Wow. Following a significant drought there, 2017 through 19. The recovery, La Nina, while it's dry weather for parts of the U.S. and South America, it's actually bigger crops, particularly for Australia and even across a lot of India, as the correlation is quite opposite on that.
So, director of the International Grains Program, IGP, at Kansas State University, Guy Allen. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Record wheat production in Russia highlights USDA's August global production forecast.
We are currently forecasting a record large Russian wheat crop of 88 million metric tons, and that reflects increases in both winter wheat and spring wheat.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekodowski says in addition to Russia's wheat production forecast,
we're also anticipating a large crop in Australia. We raised our production forecast there by 3 million tons. And also a good crop in Canada, up considerably from last year's drought-damaged crop.
At a projected 3 million ton month-over-month increase in Chinese wheat production, and Jekodowski says for the current crop year,
world production is up. We raised it 8 million tons
to a now record wheat production forecast of over 779 million tons. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.